Hey guys, this is Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their process and their job. Today, we have an in-studio guest. It's Brian Anderson. You might not know this, but he was a sideline reporter for the San Antonio Spurs for nearly a decade and had many memorable interactions with head coach Greg Popovich.
When I got the job in Milwaukee and I left the Spurs, he called me in his office. I honestly thought he was going to rip me a new one. But I walk in there, and what he said that day lifted me up to a place and encouraged me to a place where I probably wouldn't have been able to go to Milwaukee and perform like I did. Because, you know, he said things to me that day I had no idea he was even paying attention to. And, you know, he gave me a big hug. He goes, you know, I will. The one thing at the end, he said, you know, you're a great asset to our organization, and you'll be a great asset to the Brewers.
The conversation also includes talking about what it's like to prepare both for a local broadcast, as Brian does with the Brewers, and national broadcast, as he does for Turner. The day that he had to replace Marv Albert on just 48 hours' notice and turned out to call a really memorable and legendary Kentucky-Notre Dame basketball game, I think helped vaulted Brian Anderson in the minds of his bosses. All that and more coming up. A conversation with Brian Anderson of Turner Sports and the Milwaukee Brewers. Hey guys, this is Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Today, we have an in-studio guest who already is stirring up trouble by throwing me off my usually sound and beautiful intro. It's Brian Anderson. This guy has way too many jobs. Let's see if I can get this bio down. You will know him from this month from Turner Sports as being one of the voices of the NCAA tournament. He also does select NBA games for Turner. Brian, you should just jump in anytime.
You're doing great, man.
Major League. Do you do any baseball for Turner? Yes, you do the playoffs.
I do the Sunday MLB
and the Sunday. Right. Okay.
Right. Right. Thanks for watching.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible job. Jeez. We'll edit that out. You do the PGA Championship.
Yep.
And then I don't even know if I want to call it a primary job now because it's sort of co-primary job. You are the play-by-play announcer for the Milwaukee Brewers on Fox Sports Wisconsin. This is your 11th season doing that.
Great.
All right.
You did great.
Yeah. So welcome.
That's exactly how I wrote it.
Yeah. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Oh,
as you can hear, the intro has been thrown off. Brian Anderson is here in New York with us. I believe he's the fourth in studio guest behind J.A. Adande of ESPN, who came with his girlfriend. That's one. So he had a posse.
Did you make her leave the room?
No, she was here.
Oh.
Only we make the Turner PR people leave
the
room.
The handlers.
As we did. Apologies to Jay. Two, we had Paul Heyman. This is before Lose Time, our producer, legendary WWE, WWF wrestling guy. He had two people, but you could expect it. That's a legend. He has his own photographer.
Right.
And his own, and a buddy who came with him. Jim Miller has come here, the author of These Guys Have All the Fun, the ESPN book, but he's a writer, so he didn't have any posse. He came by himself. And I feel like there was, and Adnan Virk, this is again before Lou Pellegrino's time, came to the studio. Solo.
Mm.
So in terms of, Brian, no offense to you, before I start the interview,
yeah.
In terms of how I would see sort of ego management, Adnan Virk would be at the lowest. He came by himself.
Right.
You have a PR guy. Mm. Heyman has two. And Adande, I think, brought his girlfriend because this is a cool-looking studio.
But you're judging...
By the way, I hope that's Adande's girlfriend.
Keep the wives separate from the girlfriends. Different sections, first baseline, third baseline. No, but you're judging the handling part. Part of it is that I need a ride. I don't know my way around New York.
That's
so
true.
He's just driving me around.
You're a Milwaukee guy.
And he's a good baseball guy, so we just talk baseball.
We should give his last name.
Jay Moskowitz?
Jay Moskowitz.
Yeah.
Former works for the Orioles as
good
well.
Good man.
Brian, is it before we get into this interview, is when you're a Midwest guy, you live in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I'm a Texconsonite is the
Texconsonite.
Way I say it.
Okay.
From Texas, live in the upper Midwest in Milwaukee, and very happy to be from both places.
Is New York an interesting city for you? Is it too fast? Is it too much? Or do you like the contrast between... a smaller city in Milwaukee?
No, I'm definitely the small town. I grew up in a small town in Texas. New York is very intimidating for me.
Really?
Very, you know, I love being here. I come here all the time, and I feel like, you know, where we stay when we do games here, it's pretty centrally located, and you can, you know, do a lot and see a lot, and I haven't ventured out too much. I will say the one thing I do like about coming to New York in the summertime is being able to go play golf somewhere, so get out of the city a little bit, and right. then to see that part of New York. And
you go north, like to the
I've been to Westchester County okay. and been to New Jersey and wherever I can. I love to play, and to be able to get that perspective of New York is interesting for me, and where I'm probably more comfortable. I feel the anxiety of the city when I'm here, and it's not a place that I feel like I could live in and thrive.
It's interesting you say that, because by the way, most of New York as a state, once you go north and west, it's like the Midwest.
Right.
It's sort of almost farm country.
Sure. And my wife's from Poughkeepsie.
Yeah, so
by way of Canada.
Love Canada.
Poughkeepsie, New York.
So that's what's interesting about, you know, there's a perception, obviously, most of the sort of, you know, people's perception of New York State comes through New York City, obviously, you know, biggest city in the country, et cetera, et cetera. But much of New York State is really like, you might as well live in Ohio
mm-hmm.
or Iowa, because it's a lot of farming and stuff like that. All right, listen, Brian, you're here in New York, you're in the studio, and you've already thrown me off what is usually an excellent opening.
You did that in like the fifth take. I thought it was great.
Fifth take. So let's start off. Let's try to focus, Brian. I know this is hard.
Are we still in the intro part of this, or have we moved on into the content?
Brian, as a professional broadcaster, I know this is hard.
I feel like this is all going to be edited down later.
It might be. All right, let's start with this.
Okay.
How can one navigate between being a national announcer mm-hmm. for Turner and then calling a singular team as you do for the Brewers? And I want you to go long on this, from both navigating schedule and navigating just the larger notion of you're so focused on one thing, mm-hmm. and then when you do Turner, it's a much broader scope for you.
Right. Well, keep me in line here and help me remember all the pieces that you want to hear about. But for me, it's not much different. And I would say that I spent 9 years doing minor league baseball, and they say, wow, what's the difference between calling a minor league baseball game on the radio versus doing a major league game on television versus a nationally televised game? The only time I ever thought about the difference between local TV, national TV, is when I did the Brewers in the postseason. So I did that twice, 2008 and 2011. And I had to think about it a lot. And I had to think about the way I say things and make sure that, you know, I'm covering bases that I never covered before, because I want to make sure that it doesn't feel like there's any bias. It's not that there would be bias. It's just that I know so much about the team I see every day.
Right.
I don't have to prep for it. So it just, I can think of things in an instant when you're trying to maybe fill those gaps or bring context to a story or a player or what he's doing. And so that part of it was the only real stress I ever felt. Like, am I giving enough? I remember in the NLCS in 2011, my thought constantly was, am I giving enough to the Cardinals? Am I giving enough to Albert Pujols? Is there enough information here? Because I don't know them as intimately as I do my own team that I cover every day. So, but otherwise, I don't think much about it, because I've always been an announcer that my philosophy of play-by-play is to, A, just try to celebrate success. So whatever the success is where I'm going to go. That's where I want to go. Now, with a local team, you may frame that this way. You may say, this pitcher against the Brewers has success because. On a national game, you would say, this pitcher has success because. So you're not changing the paradigm there, and you're not always bringing it from a Brewers perspective when you do a national game, right? You would just... It's actually easier to do a national game for me, because it just you're covering both sides. You've usually had greater access. Like, I have great access to the team I cover every day, but not so much the visiting team. You may get a pop with the manager. You might be able to talk to a few of the players, but those players see a Fox Sports Wisconsin credential come their way, and they're playing for the New York Mets. They're not going to be as apt to have a long conversation. So that's the mechanics part of it, and actually calling the play-by-play, but calling plays, setting up the analyst, all of those elements are all the same for me. It never changes. Travel-wise, when you're with the team, you travel with the team, you're on the charters, you're at the hotel. I'm a team employee, so I'm constantly in that traveling party, that cycle. Like, I get per diem. So players walk onto the plane and they hand you your per diem, and I'm part of that group. And the charter travel's phenomenal. You know, it's like stepping onto a bus and you end up in the next city. And that's one thing about the big leagues that's so great that, you know, I always wanted to get to the big leagues for that reason was, after being on the buses for 9 years in the minor leagues, that I knew the travel piece was going to be so much better. The food's better. The hotels are better. The charter travel, airplane charter travel, which gets you from place to place. So on the network side, that's commercial travel. So that brings a different element to it. So now you've got to go, you know, you've got to go through airports just like anybody else would on a business trip. You know, I don't have private jets like some announcers do. I don't, right. I don't do that. But, you know, you do have to deal with all of that, transportation, airports, hotels, and you have somebody who books that for you. But it is a little more complicated. In the big leagues, you never think about it. You never touch your bag. You just show up in your room.
Even for the broadcasters.
Even the broadcasters. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I know that. Wow.
Traveling secretary or the director of team travel, in our case, a guy named Dan LeRae, is as good as it gets. And everything's buttoned up. You get on the you get off the plane on the bus. The bus is literally 10 steps from the airplane. You get on the bus. They hand you your key when you walk on the bus, your key to the hotel.
Wow.
So they've already delivered the package of all the keys. So you don't even check in. You don't go, you know, and then you don't go to the front desk. And so that's one thing about the big leagues that people ask me, like, why do you still do that? And those are a lot of the reasons, but that would be the major difference, is that you're a little bit on your own, even though you have somebody book your travel on the network side.
When you are preparing for a national broadcast, let's say it's a National League Championship game, or your one of the games you're going to do for Turner and CBS, you mentioned before that the Brewers, at this point, it's muscle memory, it's osmosis, you're also around the team. This will be foreign to you, at least in terms of being around some of these teams. So as deep as you want to go, let's take college basketball, for instance. If you learn that you have Kentucky Murray State, what is your preparation starting from the moment that you learn those teams?
It's a lot different in the tournament than it would be for a regular season game, because you just don't have the time to prep. And for me, I've always been a prep guy. I do my own prep. I feel like it's important to dive in and try to learn as much as I can and tell stories. And I'm sincerely curious and interested in what these players are and the context of how they got here and why they do what they do. So that's a really fun part for me, is to do that. And you can't do that in the NCAA tournament. For me, specifically this year, so I'll be on the air Tuesday. I'm not sure when this airs, but I'll be on the air Tuesday for the first four from Dayton on True TV. Hmm. That's four teams. I've got...
You only learn Sunday, right?
You'll learn that Sunday night.
Right.
So I'll lay out what the schedule is, and I'll tell you how I would prepare for the tournament, which is different than any other thing I prepare for. So I'll find out Sunday when everybody else does, when Greg Gumbel makes the announcement. And then I'll know exactly where I'm going, what teams I have. So I know I'm going to Dayton, working with Clark Kellogg on Tuesday. We're the first game of the NCAA tournament on True TV Tuesday from Dayton, right? Okay. Then after that game, we immediately get into travel mode. We don't know how we're getting to the next place. Sometimes we drive. Sometimes we take the NCAA charter, which takes the team, the bands, the cheerleaders, whatever is available. Sometimes we go commercial. So we'll find that out depending on where my site will be. So once I find out the next site for the first round game, which will be Thursday, so you've traveled Tuesday night. Wednesday is the hardest day of the tournament for an announcer, because you spend all day at the arena for eight practices of all eight teams that will be in that pod. And those are 1 hour practices, and you're cramming as fast as you can to learn as much as you can from the SIDs, from the coaches, the players. It's a very fast window. So you go from the first four to the practice day, which is the stress day, and then the game day, which is actually fine. The game day is great. You do four games, which is not hard to call a basketball game. It's not hard. It's not physically challenging. You've done all the prep work. But those are 4 days when you have to be on the air, air's in the balloon, you're kind of on the edge of your seat, and you do all these games, and you hope you get all the moments correct. And then you stop down. Now you have four more practices on Friday, two more games on Saturday. So that's the run of this first week in the NCAA tournament. So you cannot prepare for those games like I would any regular season game or NBA game, because there's not enough time to do it. So we have this great web connection, this web app that we use that allows us to watch any game that's been played.
Right.
So we will go onto this app, and I'll be able to call up whatever teams I have, and I'll be able to watch these games. And I watch them for a different reason than the analysts would. Analysts are looking at flow. They're looking at rotations, all these things that makes an analyst. And I usually would do that, but in these games, I'm only looking at these clips to ID players.
Right.
So the first step for me is to ID every player, and I may pick out whatever. He's dreadlocks, he wears a headband, he has a brace on his elbow, he wears, you know, whatever. I'm just looking for anything that differentiates these guys. And I'm just purely going on an ID basis. And I will pause that when five players are on the floor, and I'll say, there's Smith, there's Johnson, there, and I will just go around the horn and try to memorize those players. Because for me, once I know the players, now I can attach everything to that tree trunk. All those branches of information, what the coach says about them. If I have a visual of what, you know, Lonzo Ball looks like, which is an easy one, but if I have that visual and I know what his number is, then I can now attach all this information. Melo Trimble, number two, wears his hair in kind of a high top fade. I have that visual, right? And so anything somebody would say about Melo Trimble, in my mind, I would attach that to the trunk of that tree as a branch. Okay, well, I remember Mark Turgeon said this about Melo Trimble, or you know, this coach said this, or this was written about him. And once I have the names, then it's much easier for me to process that information. So this is totally different than I would do for a normal game, but I'm throwing as much into my short-term memory and face and player recognition as I can. Because the one thing I don't want to do is when I get into a game, especially with the importance of an NCAA tournament game, is look down at my notes, look up, and all the crowd is going crazy and Chris Webber's jumping up and down and I have no idea what happened because I'm trying to ID a player on my board or read a note about him that I've written. And I do write down everything. I have this board and I write down all the players. I write down all the notes that I may have. But usually when I write it, I will remember it or remember it enough to paraphrase. And then there's some things you know you can use like during a timeout or coming back from a break or during a free throw. So those elements you know you can go down and read. But I want to keep my eyes on the floor because I don't want to miss anything on the floor. So that's really the way it works. And then you do that, I'll have 12 teams to prep for, in this case, because I'm doing the first four, 12 teams in 6 days. And hopefully some of them I've seen in the past and I have this face recognition. So when I get to those practices, when our producer, director, Chris Webber, whoever the analyst is, when they're kind of pinned down with the SID and getting all the backstories and who's playing well, who's been hurt, I'm usually standing off to the side with my board staring at the practice court, literally moving my eyes around the floor going, that's him, that's him, that's him, that's what he, there's the shooter, there's the post, there's the point guard, especially for the smaller schools that you haven't seen. So that's probably way more detail than you wanted to hear, but that's exactly how the tournament works as opposed to a regular game when you would just, you get your board ready, you dive in, and now you just start pulling as much as you can, whatever you feel like is interesting that you can read. And then when you go and visit with the coaches or the players themselves, when you get on site, that's usually when I add most of my content. I want to give things to the audience that is not in a media guide. And if it's a great story, I will always credit the writer and a story that's written. And just basically at this point, which I never used to do, refer back to, hey, just Google search or log on to expressnews.com and read or myessay.com and read the story on Kawhi Leonard. And I'll give the credit to the writer and let, he's done the work, let people go find that if they want.
Yeah, first of all, it's a podcast. We want you to go long, so you shouldn't, don't be apologizing okay. for that. That's a very, to me, that was a really interesting explanation. What about when the names are problematic? A foreign player?
Yeah.
How do you go, because the, what would be interesting to me is, again, these are teams you have never seen prior to calling them, and what happens if, let's say, one of their star players, I'm just making this up, is from Lithuania and mm-hmm. it's a challenging name. Do you have an exercise where you'll say that name 50 times yeah. so it becomes muscle memory, or how
exactly.
do you do it?
No, and I think, and that's a great question, and I don't feel like those names and those players are ever a problem because you see that name right away.
Right.
And you immediately lock in on it and say, I cannot. For me, messing up the names is like the greatest crime in our business. And we all do it. Like, I've messed up names before. So those names, They're the ones that you spend the most time on, and you're constantly just repeating, rehearsing in your mind. Every time you see this player, for me, I make the visual connection to the mind, and I'll see this player, and I'll say, that is so-and-so, that is Teletovic, or that is whatever the player is. And then the ones that get you are names that are pretty familiar, the Brian Andersons of the world, that may be a Brett Anderson, that may be a Billy Anderson, that, you know, those are the ones that get you, because I may have friends that have had a name, you know. I remember Derek Turnbow was a closer for the Brewers my first year, and I had a friend of mine that was Donnie Turnbow was his name, and I was like, and I couldn't make the separation.
You kept calling him Donnie?
I called him Donnie the first time, and people killed me. And rightly so. Here's the new guy and doesn't even know our players. So those names like that are, you know, the Mike Davises, you know, the Michael Davis, the Malcolm Davis, those are the kind of names that get you. And so, and you may have seen a guy who would have a very similar name or similar last name, and you instantly make this connection. And DJ Wilson's a great example. So DJ Wilson plays for Michigan, your team, right? Yeah. So DJ Wilson's great, but every time I say his name, I hesitate because I want to say CJ Wilson, the pitcher who I've called hundreds of games before and have said his name thousands and thousands of times, and it just that you know, CJ Wilson, DJ Wilson, they don't look alike. It's a different sport, but it's just that muscle memory that burns in your brain that wants to come out. And I've said DJ Wilson so many times, and every time I pause and go, did I say D? Did I say the D? Did I say the C? So those are the ones that actually cause me the most stress.
That's interesting. I just pulled this up because I wanted to see. It's you and Weber, at least you know, in the regional rounds. I imagine you would go further than that. And Lewis Johnson, is that your reporter throughout?
Yep.
Have you you've worked with Weber before?
Oh, yeah.
I know this. Have you worked with Chris and Lewis together as a partnership?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't think so. Okay. I've worked with Lewis often, but never with Chris. I may have in the NBA. I'm not sure. I worked with Chris and Grant Hill when Grant was just starting. We did a lot of games together. I worked with Chris. I feel like Lewis was on the Kentucky Notre Dame. I think he was.
Interesting. And because I think most people know him obviously from his Olympic work,
yeah,
track and field. So he's a good reporter.
He's great. He works hard. He's you know, all those guys at Turner, on the guys and gals, they're fantastic. I was a reporter too. I was a sideline reporter with the Spurs, I know how difficult that job can be. So yeah, they're all great. And Lewis and I, matter of fact, when Marv Albert lost his voice, I filled in for him. Lewis was on that crew. Chris Weber and Lynn Elmore.
Kentucky Notre Dame 2015.
Yeah, right. Okay. Lynn Elmore and Chris Weber were in the analyst chair, and then Lewis was the reporter that year.
So that was the foursome. Wow.
As a matter of fact, Lewis, I believe that was the year Sagers got sick and wasn't able to continue. So Lewis and I went from the first four. We drove to Pittsburgh together with Steve Smith. And the day we got there, remember I told you about how difficult that day was, that Wednesday? So we go to all these practices, and here's Lewis just grinding like everybody else. And they pulled him aside and said, by the way, you're going to go join the A crew, the A Turner crew, and you're going to join Marv and those guys. And so he left us. And then Dana came in, Dana Jacobson on a whim, and she did great. So, yeah, I remember, you know, I did a bunch of games with Lewis, and then he went to that group, and then I rejoined him.
So. You mentioned that game. That's the Midwest regional final, mm-hmm, between Kentucky and Notre Dame in 2015. Marv Albert loses his voice. You get called in essentially less than 48 hours, mm-hmm, prep. That game turns out to be an all-time game. How important do you think that game was in terms of where you are now, calling that game, getting, I think, a lot of critical praise for calling that game? The game is great, so your bosses remember and the country, mm-hmm, remembers. Do you ever think about if that game was a blowout? I mean, maybe you're still in the same place,
maybe,
but it had to have helped you. You agree?
Yeah. I mean, that would be you'd be able to answer that question because you would have a great sense of that. When you're in it, you don't feel that. I do remember a couple of things from that window. First of all, I had already called Notre Dame. So the game that Notre Dame won to get to that level, to get to the Sweet 16 round, and this was ultimately an Elite Eight game that I called, but Notre Dame beat Butler in the round of 32, and I had that game. So I had Notre Dame's first two games, and Notre Dame was a really familiar team to me. So the fact that they were the team that went in, I'd had them in the regional prior to. But so once I finished with that first round, I went back to Phoenix for spring training baseball. I didn't have anything that I would wear in an NBA or an NCAA tournament setting, a basketball setting. I had no coat and tie. I was just in my, you know, my Fox Sports Wisconsin golf shirt for spring training baseball the rest of the way. So I had no clothes.
Wow.
That would be appropriate for an NCAA tournament game. That was my first challenge. I do remember when I got the call from Tara August that I said, why me? Like, why do you want me to do this game? And I was very hesitant. I was trying to be, you know, I didn't feel like I maybe deserved the chance. It's just kind of where I always come from in my career. Like, I'm such a fan.
Plus, it's replacing Marvell.
Of all the play-by-play announcers who do this. And, you know, and I am a fan. And I love the art of broadcasting, and I study it. And so these are my, even though I was an athlete and I played college baseball and I love, you know, following athletes. It wasn't like that. It was, you know, the announcers were the ones I kind of gravitated to and studied. And so I just, my first question was, well, why me? Why do you feel like there's so many great announcers out there? Why don't you use one of them? And I was actually ready to not do it. I was pretty much prepared to say, no, that's not something I'm ready for, not knowing if I was ready or not. And right. She, to her credit, she said, well, you're doing it and you're going to be great at it. And we're going to get you on a plane ASAP. Now, there was a bigger challenge was I actually had a television game, spring training television game that Saturday that right. Even though it's spring training and everybody kind of scoffed.
You work for the Brewers.
And the eye roll is like, okay, spring training baseball. But, you know, I made a commitment to the Brewers
right.
And my commitment with the NCAA tournament was over and now I'm back with the Brewers. And so we had to work that out too. And that got complicated because we had to figure out how to fly another announcer to do the Brewers game. As a matter of fact, Turner actually flew the my backup announcer, who a guy by the name of Craig Cashon, they flew him from Milwaukee on the Turner dime from Milwaukee to Phoenix.
To do the
Brewers game because they obviously had to provide
the
backup. And so they put him up in the hotel and the whole deal. So Turner really made it work. And then I had, you know, very little time to gather up and go do this game. And, you know, those are all the backstories. Once I got to Cleveland, Scott Cockrell, the producer, had sent a couple of guys out to Men's Warehouse and had a couple of navy blazers to choose from. And that's what I wore. And, of course, Chris Weber and Lynn Elmore were fantastic. And the crew was great. I knew most of the crew. So once I got there, I didn't feel like something that was different to me. It felt like a lot was different when all of the news was going on about it. Marv Albert, Brian Anderson's going to fill in for him. So once I kind of got in the bubble, and, you know, I had a lot of work to do on Kentucky because I hadn't prepped for them. So, you know, that was really the most important piece to that was just getting there. And then once I got there, I never, and I still really haven't thought about it, what that moment meant, but it was a great game. Had Jaren Grant made that shot, that would have been, for me, maybe the new Leitner moment because it would have propelled him to the Final Four.
Right.
And he missed it. And I never saw it. Like, he went to the corner. I said, go to any corner except that far one because I can't see over there if it's a three or a two or if he steps out of bounds. And so, and he went straight to the opposite corner, and I can just like, oh, man. So I have to take it off the monitor now.
Right.
So you shift your eyes from the live action to the monitor, which is always scary for an announcer. And had he made it, man, it would have been one of those moments, you know, iconic moments. And so I think between the Roy Halladay no-hitter and that game, if nothing else, from my perspective, it showed or at least proved to my bosses that, okay, he can do a game of this magnitude. And for me, it was just making the calls and, you know, the rhythm of it was normal for me.
I think the larger lesson is always listen to Tara August, who knows what the hell she's doing in Turner Sports.
Yeah, for sure.
How realistic is it for you to do both of these for the long term? You obviously have made your commitment to the Brewers is legit. This is your 11th year doing mm-hmm. that. You live there. You're part of the community. But now you have national responsibility. So often you see broadcasters eventually leave the local team to sort of focus nationally. We just mentioned Marv. You know, he's the Knicks broadcaster forever. And then at a certain point, he became, I think it was maybe during the NBC time or after, but regardless, now he's just a, he's a national broadcaster, and you've seen other broadcasters do this. Is it your intention to do both for the rest of your career? And if so, how realistic is it for you to schedule between the two?
It is my intention to do both, as long as each will have me. Not playing the humble card, but that I really do. I'm fortunate. I feel very grateful that both parties have been able to work together. And for a time there, before I signed this deal with Turner, for a time there, it was always Turner asking the Brewers if they could borrow me, basically. Can we have him for these dates? And then the Brewers were great about allowing me to do it. I think Bob Uecker set that precedent in Milwaukee, and of course, he's still the radio announcer in Milwaukee. So the fact that he did it, and it was kind of part of the process, and he did Mr. Belvedere and the Tonight Show, and he did national games, national baseball games.
I mean, so he was, obviously I grew up, Uecker's famous. So he was doing all that stuff and still was
He always did the Brewers.
Okay, so he
Since 1971, he's never not done the Brewers.
So he'd fly out to do Carson, maybe somebody fill him from that day, and he'd fly back.
And then the run of Mr. Belvedere, that took a lot of his time, especially when they started shooting for that show. I don't know what that show lasted, 7 years maybe.
They filmed in Los Angeles too?
I believe they did.
Wow. Okay.
So he's I asked him. I said, Bob, you know, how many games did you do, or how many did you feel like you could do comfortably? And you know, he said, you know, 90 to 100 was a good number.
Right.
And I'll say about so that precedent was set with Mr. Baseball, and everybody knows how great he is, and he had his roots in Milwaukee. He's from Milwaukee, so that's different than me. I'm from Texas, but Milwaukee's my home now. I have no intention of leaving, and I am committed there because I love everything that Milwaukee stands for, and the Brewers and the local team. And right now, Turner and the Brewers connect perfectly. If you put up the schedule and you have the 6 months of the winter months, let's say the off-season baseball months, and then the 6 months of the baseball, which is actually seven, but they fit well. The only time it doesn't fit is spring training right now, and then the first month of the baseball season, now that I do the NBA playoffs, I miss from mid-April to mid-May. So other than that, and selected weekends once you get into the summer for MLB on TBS, it works really well together. And I love the work, and I enjoy it. I'm down to about 100 games with the Brewers, and give or take a few, depends on how many we televise. But I love the fact that I can go do baseball. I always explain it this way. If you rent a car, that car doesn't feel right to you. But it's a car. It's a really nice car, maybe, and you're driving the car, but it's not totally comfortable. And the Brewers are my car. Like, that's what I feel. I sit in that car, and I feel good in that car, and everything's exactly where I want it and where I know it to be. And so that's the comfortable side of it, and I love showing up at the ballpark. And it makes me better, too, to be on the air a lot. So I feel like if I'm on the air every night, if I go along, I'm not one of those guys that can, like, Joe Buck amazes me. He's so great at what he does. The fact that he can pop in, do these massive games, and be so fluid and so cool. I don't feel like I have that talent. I'm better when I'm in reps, when I'm getting shots up, when I'm getting games in. And so for me, it just makes perfect sense, you know? And I've kind of been the guy all these years, going back to when I even first started, like, why are you doing that? Can you do both? Can you be a cameraman? Can you be a radio announcer? Why would you want to be this guy? And I've always just like, everything builds to the other, and whatever makes me is part of everything that I do, and I enjoy all of it. I truly do, and I don't want to stop doing it if I don't have to. Now, if the responsibilities of Turner got greater and greater, then, you know, of course, we'd have to look at it. But I really don't see the way the rights are right now with all the events, all the sports that they have, nothing really conflicts in a major way with the Milwaukee Brewers.
How are you better as a baseball broadcaster in 2017 than you were in 2015?
I hope
so. Than you were in 2013?
Man, I hope so.
Okay, why?
I mean, why? Hopefully I'm better every year. I work at it, you know, for one. I listen to games. It's really important to me to listen to calls and listen, you know, watch opens and listen to what I try to do is I usually wait about a month so I forget all the thoughts and all the communication in my brain or from the producer through the IFB. I try to wait a month so I forget all that, because if I watched the game the next day and I said, all right, let me just see how this sounds and feels, I would still have all those memories in mind. And what you hear on the air, it's just a totally different world when you're in the bubble doing a game and you're listening to this traffic, and it's just different. I don't know how to explain it other than there's a lot more noise than you can ever imagine. And so I like to forget about all that, then watch it from an audience perspective. And yeah, you know, I try to think about things, you know, am I giving my analyst enough time? Am I talking too much? I'm very aware of all that, the mechanics of it. Did I call that correctly? Was I late? So I still do the same things when I did minor league baseball, and I would pop the cassette tape in my Honda Civic on the way home and listen to as much of the game as I could. I still do the same kind of critique, and it's still as uncomfortable now as it was then to listen to yourself and critique yourself. And so, yes, I mean, I want to be better, and I think I am, because the way I try to, you know, prune as much as I can away things that aren't acceptable or that I feel aren't necessary. So I can't give you specific examples other than, you know, I think I'm a lot more comfortable now and confident on the air, and I trust my vocabulary at this point in my career. I've been doing this since 1994 professionally. So, you know, there is a little bit of that switch. That was a major click. Instead of writing everything down, feeling like I had to read everything and having notes and constantly like outline, okay, think, what are your talking points? Once I kind of broke away from that and trusted what I saw and what I, you know, trusted my vocabulary and the words I could come up with and the thought or the story or the connection, that was a lot of freedom for me to be able to just kind of wing it.
How do I sort of phrase this? There used to be something called a New York style baseball broadcast, where the broadcasters would oftentimes be critical of the team that they were broadcasting. Maybe critical is a little too strong a word, but they weren't over the top homers per se. Right. This is like the Marty Glickman style, if you've heard of him. Sure. I think Gary Cohen is pretty good at that. You know, let's not go crazy. This is not killing the team, but it's different than the Hawk Harrelson style of broadcasting. You're in a city that's, like a lot of major league cities, parochial. They love their team. When the Brewers do something that is, this is not the perfect phrasing, but worthy of criticism, or something happens to a player where it really calls for the audience to sort of know what's up, how much freedom do you have to do that, given the fact that you're ultimately paid by the team?
Well, we're lucky in our case. We have total freedom. Mark Adonasio, the owner of the Brewers, has never, and his people below him who would pass instructions through, none of those bosses have ever come to me and said, don't say this, you can't say this, this is how we'll handle this. We had a major situation with Ryan Braun.
Well, I was going to get to that, because that was probably the most prominent performance-enhancing guy in the league, basically, in the last 5 years.
And then, you know, and that we found out during batting practice. I remember the San Diego Padres were in town, and we found out during batting practice that day. And we didn't get any instruction on, which we were actually kind of eager for some instruction, at least a statement from the organization, and they eventually did before the game, but we had already hit the air by that point. You know, from a play-by-play perspective, anything on the field is free game. I'm always really leery about if you think you know something, or you think you know why a player might. I'll give you a good example. We had a player, Ramos Ramirez, and they didn't want to publicize the fact that he had a hamstring injury. It was a knee injury. And we didn't know that. And he kept jogging to first base. Okay, so as a play-by-play announcer, what do you do? Or as an analyst, it's a much more burden on my partner as an analyst and a former big leaguer than the play-by-play guy. I can always just do play-by-play. Okay, so we see him at least three times jog to first base. All right? Now, I've called enough baseball to know, and Aramis Ramirez was a jogger. He jogged to first base all the time in his career, right? So am I going to call him out, or am I going to say, wow, he's really not running down the line? When the fact that he's doing it in such a slow way, my thought was there's something wrong with him.
Right.
But I didn't know there was anything wrong with him. So I the first time I saw it, or the first couple of times, I didn't say anything. And then I went down. Ron Reneke was the manager at the time. I said, Ron, is Aramis Ramirez hurt? And he goes, I can't tell you. Hmm. And so now I kind of feel like something's going on. So I just asked Aramis, you got anything going on? You're not running to first base. And he goes, my knee's a little bit, you know. So anyway, on the air the next time, he jogs to first base. I go, you know, and I just told it just like that. I talked to Aramis Ramirez. We noticed he hasn't been running to first base hard. Instead of criticizing him, I asked him, and he said, is there something going on? He wouldn't elaborate much. And then I just left it at that. And then I'm not, but I know fans at home are, oh my God, this guy can't even, you know, run down the first baseline. That should have been an easy double. And I get that, and that's fine. But for me, I feel like there's always more to the story, especially in baseball. There's so much failure. And you don't know, like, when there's a fight or an argument or somebody does something they shouldn't have. Carlos Gomez was a lightning rod for the Brewers, and he had a pretty famous incident with Brian McCann when McCann was playing for the Braves.
That's right.
And I'll say this, like, I know the backstory of a lot of that, and I know that Brian McCann can very subtly get under people's skin, and Gomez is a player that most opponents can easily engage or enrage without really doing much.
Right.
And when he hits a home run and he runs around and he's flipping out at Brian McCann, I know that's not the first incident. Like, I just know there's something more going on. So I'm not going to jump on the Carlos Gomez has to quiet things down. He is, you know, I'm not going to just be that guy unless I know for a fact. I just feel like I don't know all the information all the time to be able to do that. Now, if I do and a guy just makes a bad play or, you know, does something he shouldn't do, or it's a boneheaded play, then just say it. You know, but I usually phrase it this way when I'm with the team. I don't necessarily do it on the national games, but I'll just say, boy, that's a pitch he would like to have back, or he would probably tell you he should have made that play, because I know he would if most players think they should make a catch in the outfield. So that, for me, if I just phrase it that way, instead of my opinion and me being, you know, up here and being the judgmental play-by-play announcer, I can just say, let's bring it back down to his level. He knows he messed up. Look at his reaction. I would hope our director, and sometimes I'll call for it, director would get a shot of him with his head in his hands and upset. You know, there's so much more to it, and usually players know right away when they screw up, and I also know how hard the game is. So that's a long answer for a pretty easy question, but I do – that's like our biggest challenge, and that's the most often asked question that we get is, you're such a homer. How can you be fair? We slant it towards the Brewers. Everything is from a Brewers perspective, but whatever happens on the field, people can see. You can't hide behind that.
What was it like calling Braun in 2014? That's the year after the suspension. You know, it's interesting. He had a great year last year.
Great year.
You know, and you want to believe it was clean. If nothing else, we do know that he was suspended, and we do know that he comes back that next year, and everyone in baseball is looking at him. You got to call him however many games you call him. So this is a multiple-part question. One, what was that like for you calling him that year? And then secondly, what is your relationship with him in terms of the broadcaster-player relationship, with the larger subtext of this is a player who is known nationally for negative reasons?
Yeah, well, first of all, the relationship is great, and it was always great, and I felt like Braun was that, you know, that superstar that Milwaukee needed. Really the first guy since probably Robin Yount that could be the face of a franchise, be great in the community, and I've done a ton of charity work with him, so I know there are so many things that he does, and then there are so many things that nobody knows that he does. I just know, not that he's told me or had any kind of, you know, handler tell me. I just know what he does. I know what he's into and what he believes in. And I liked him a lot, and I thought he was great for us. He helped us sell Brewers baseball every night, and then this comes down, and it was a total shock. And we just, at that point, had to report. We had to report what we knew, what we didn't know. He's left the premises. He did not leave a statement. We haven't really gotten any statements from leadership yet, you know, at that time. And then as we got those from general manager Doug Melvin, from owner Mark Adonasio, you know, from all the higher-ups, then we aired them. And so you become, more journalists, less team employee at that point. And you say, whatever is being offered, we need to present. And so that's really all we did. And that's how we handled it. So now he comes back and he's playing. And I talked to Mike Kruko and Dwayne Kuiper a lot about this because they dealt with that with Barry Bonds. Yeah. And I love those guys. And
they're great.
Two of my favorites in sports broadcasting, period, not just baseball. But I talked to them, and they were both players. And so they understand. And so I'm always thinking about from a fan's perspective. Okay, if you're a Milwaukee Brewers fan and you're dialing up with us every night, and if we are going to beat this horse every night that Ryan Braun did wrong by the organization, now he's come back and we can't trust him, and we do that every night, we're going to ruin that experience. So in the beginning, we talked about it. We mentioned that, you know, and I thought my partner Bill Schroeder was fantastic, and he's a lifelong brewer, and I thought he was great, and he handled it really well. And we just put all the facts out there. This is what we know now. He left the team. He shouldn't have. This is something that shouldn't have happened. And he's going to have to make amends for it. And he's going to start the process now. And whatever he does from now on is going to be judged through that prism. And that's the bet he's made. But I will tell you, before that season began, Ryan Braun picked up the phone and called just about everybody in the organization, from the clubhouse managers to the broadcasters to marketing people to executives. He called each of us individually. My call came, I was in St. Louis in the hotel room, and I was shocked. And he basically took 2 weeks. He blocked time, and he got phone numbers, and he made phone calls. Now, I didn't have his cell phone, and we weren't texting, or have that kind of relationship to start with. So the fact that he called, you know, and he talked for 5 minutes. I said, "Hey, Ryan," I said, "How you doing, Ryan?" He goes, "Well, I just need to apologize." And he did. He called everybody in the organization, and he said a lot of things that, you know, what are you going to do at that point? He's made a mistake. He's now calling me directly, and he doesn't have to. I'm insignificant to what he's about to go through, and he calls me, and he apologizes, and he did that to everybody, and we're all kind of now coming together. "Did Ryan call you?" "Yeah, he called me. Called me yesterday." "Really?" "Yeah, he called me." So now it's like, man, all right, that's the next best move, right? So I'm always talking about the next best decision. And so once that happened, and I told that story on the air, and then we just kind of moved on, and we called games. We just called games, and every visiting television announcer and radio announcer would come in like, "Oh my God, Ryan Braun, how do you guys do this?" You know, and it was the same kind of feeling we had when Barry Bonds was playing in San Francisco, and you know, that's kind of how we handled it, right or wrong. I just felt like our fans didn't want to feel that beat down every day of their announcers talking about the scandal every day. So after the first couple of weeks, we did a lot in spring training. And after that first couple of weeks of the season, it was just business as usual.
I want to ask you one last one about the Brewers before moving on to something else. Chris Carter played for the Brewers last year, right?
Great guy. Sleepy.
It must be, you know, you're in the game. You're a lifer in the game. How crazy is it to you? This is just not a media question. This is the only sports question. But how crazy is it to you that a guy who hit 41 home runs, there's like no market for him? Like, literally, I feel bad for Chris
Carter.
Should
I say, go ahead, caller? This is Richard from New York.
But if Chris Carter played in like 1988,
different.
Yeah, I mean, the guy would be, you'd be like, how can we lock this guy up for 8 years? He's 20. He's not 100 years old. He's 29.
Okay. I am in full agreement with how the Brewers maneuvered through this. Not just because I work for the Brewers, but
I got you.
Chris Carter has a place in the game as a major threat, power threat. Okay. And I think he's going to have a great year with the Yankees, and what a perfect ballpark for him to play in, right?
Right.
So, but the way where the Brewers are, he was going to get a huge payday. It was going to go from, I believe, 3.5 to 9, maybe 10. And that's one thing, the Brewers aren't in a position to do that, first of all. So you non-tender him. And what did he get? Three from the Yankees?
He didn't break the bank.
Which is what the Brewers were going to have to give him.
Right.
And the Brewers have so much else to deal with, so many other things to operate in this rebuild, that was the last thing on their mind. They ended up striking oil, they hope, with this guy, Eric Thames, who was basically the left-handed Chris Carter in Korea the last 3 years.
Right.
So they'll give him a shot. He's, he signed a three-year deal for, I think, $10 million, or maybe it's $15 actually. $5 million a year. So that's the economics of it. The other part of it is, And I hate to say this because I'm a huge fan of Chris Carter. I love the guy.
Defensively is the issue, right?
It's not even that. He played fine defensively. Yeah. I thought he was way more athletic and way better than anybody thought because he was practicing every day and playing every day. But look, there's a reason why he struggled so much with bases loaded. I think he was 1 for 12. I'll have to check those facts. But I'm pretty sure at some point in the season we mentioned that with bases loaded, he was 1 for 12. He had a grand slam late in the year against the Cubs. But teams were pitching around batters ahead of him to get to Carter, especially the elite pitchers, because he was a strikeout, and the strikeouts are the best way out of jams. And Carter then became a bit of a hole in the lineup. Now, I don't want to disparage him. This is only, I'm talking about from a strategic managerial perspective, you had to be really careful where you put Chris Carter in the lineup, because if you have all these on-base guys and now he comes up, you're going to leave a lot of guys on base. And I think the Brewers were at the top or near the top in runners left on base last year.
Right.
And a lot of it was because of Chris Carter batting so often with men on base. And he had a good season. He had a lot of home runs. But he wasn't, you know, that clutch guy that at the level where the Brewers felt like, we got to make this guy a multi-year offer. So that's to answer your question. And you're right. To say that, how can you let the guy who led the league in home runs, how can he be non-tendered? Well, I think the market bared that out and showed you why, because he didn't get that kind of offer. And I hope he has a great career. I hope he proves everybody wrong in Milwaukee and has a great run in New York. But for me right now, the Brewers just aren't in that position to make that play. They have to get playing time and perform elsewhere in so many other different positions.
Does 2011 feel long ago? Because that was the year 96 and 66. I'm looking this up now. It's not like I know the Brewers record off the top of my head, but you know, that was an excellent team.
Yeah.
And the Brewers were at a place where people thought, like, you know, legit series contenders. The next year, competitive. They finished in third, didn't make the playoffs. But then after that, it starts to go. So it's been a while, right?
Then remember in 08, it was 26 years between playoff appearances.
That's right. That was CC down the stretch.
That was one of my favorite.
They were a fun team. Yeah.
My favorite. Matter of fact, here's a side story for you. So the reason I'm at Turner is because I actually got on the MLB playoffs for TBS in 08. And the reason I got on the MLB playoffs in 08 is because CC Sabathia became such a star and was the headline. Here's CC Sabathia in Milwaukee, and he came just before the All-Star break. And he was a larger-than-life figure. He was finishing games. He was going on 3 days rest. And, you know, all of a sudden, my calls of his performances in these games – and Braun and Fielder and Corey Hart. It was just like all these
Prince Fielder,
Milwaukee
by the way, 24
stars.
Years old, 34 homers, 102 RBIs.
And clutch as it gets.
Unbelievable.
That guy was so money. And Braun was too. Braun hit that famous home run 2008. It was a grand slam. It ended up on the iPod commercial.
Boy, that was a good team. I'm looking at that. I mean, they
really
had a lot
team.
Of power. Sheets had a good year, too.
He was the starter in the All-Star game that year at Yankee Stadium, Ben Sheets. But the best part of that team were the two guys on the bench, Mark Kotze and Craig Counsell. You talk about owning a clubhouse. Ron Renicke had to do very little. Those guys had that clubhouse pinned down, and all those young, great, talented players, and then CC, of course. But anyway, this moment where all these calls were on SportsCenter and all the highlight shows, and you know the guys at Turner, this guy Howard Zalkowicz is his name, and he said, "Wow, this guy, I like this guy." And only because of CC Sabathia did anybody even pay attention. And I always tell CC, I said, "You're the reason I got on Turner in the first place. I got on TBS in the national scene." So thank you for that.
This is a good Corey Hart.
Good, great
20
team.
Homers, 91 RBIs, 23 steals that year. 459 slugging. I mean,
they picked up Jerry Hairston.
That's like the seventh guy on the team.
Jerry Hairston was a huge pickup. He ended up playing third base and was fantastic in the playoffs. And
were they one starter away? Maybe.
Well, what happened? Well, you know, their staff was great. So Zach Greinke, Giovanni Gallardo in his prime, when he was right in the middle of when he was great. Greinke was great. But then those three and four guys who had performed so well all year, Sean Markham and Randy Wolf, just had a tough time in the postseason. And, you know, that's kind of what happened. They ran into a Cardinal team that, oh my gosh, for whatever reason, they found, well, the Cardinals, Everybody talks about the Royals stacking this bullpen and the model of the Royals in 2015. It was actually the 2011 Cardinals when they acquired Zepchinski. They made a trade with Toronto, I remember, and they got Dotel and Zepchinski. So they locked the game down after the sixth inning. And so, and no starter for the Cardinals in that LCS went more than five innings.
Wow. I'm looking at that. So now you mentioned 2011. So Prince Fielder in 2011, he's now 27, 38 homers, yeah. 120 RBIs, 299 batting average. Slugging percentage was 566. His OPS, I mean, this is like video game stuff, 981. That, you know, and Braun again had a great team. Corey Hart again, that was a good team. I mean, and Luke Roy was the catcher on that team, the young Jonathan Lucroy.
And not exactly like a favorite either, because he and Randy Wolf went round and round. Randy Wolf couldn't throw to Lucroy, right. So he was but Lucroy was
but you
a
could tell he
great
was
hitter.
Gonna be a good, he was going to
sure.
be a terrific
Absolutely.
Hitter. And you mentioned all the starting pitchers, including Gallardo and Greinke. Wow,
yeah. And K-Rod locking it down.
Oh, that's right.
Frankie Rodriguez, K-Rod. You know, he got the closer's job back.
So LaTroy Hawkins part of that
team. Yeah, LaTroy. That was a really fun team. And speaking of a guy who had the clubhouse locked down.
Oh, that guy, he had a great career.
Oh, man.
I mean, phenomenal.
Phenomenal. I think he can still pitch right now.
He's
doing television. You should know that. He's doing TV for the Twins.
For the Twins, yeah.
Yeah.
And the Twins brought in Torrey Hunter, too.
They did. They bought a mix of guys to do Twins baseball along with Burt Blyleven and Jack Morris.
That's cool. All right, let's finish up on this. I want to get to your early days in San Antonio. And reading up, you called the San Antonio Missions AA, is that right?
That's right.
Home games at one point on the radio in 1994 for $25 a game.
That's right. That's my first year, yep.
Yeah.
I clocked in with the vendors.
I love that.
And down the left field line, I had a punch card.
And, you know, we have a lot of college students who listen to this podcast. So you started off basically, You right out of college, you eventually get to San Antonio fairly quickly, and you decide to be an intern, right, for the Spurs director of broadcasting named, how do I pronounce that guy's name?
Mike Kikarillo.
Mike Kikarillo, who is very famous in that world for you, Michelle Beadle.
Right.
There's, you know, he sort of like started a lot of these careers. And what was interesting to me was that you not only were doing baseball, but you wanted to become involved in basketball too, right? So
sure.
Tell the story of you eventually getting to the point where you become the sideline reporter for the Spurs.
All right, how much time do you want out of this? Because this is a long story.
Yeah,
okay,
go for it.
So, I need to rearrange a little bit.
Right.
So I go to St. Mary's University. I transferred. I need to back up one step. I was playing college baseball in my hometown, Georgetown, Texas, for Southwestern University. They dropped scholarships and went to Division III, and I wanted to play at a higher level, so I transferred. I went to St. Mary's, and it totally changed my life. I no longer wanted to be a business major. I wanted to pursue broadcasting and journalism, and so I did that at St. Mary's. And St. Mary's, and we were a powerhouse NAIA baseball team, and so I really loved playing there. And we shared the field with the San Antonio Missions, the AA team at that time of the Dodgers. So we shared the field. We would operate, you know, we would pull the tarp for them. I would go fetch home run balls from Mike Piazza and Eric Carlson
nice.
When they were coming through AA San Antonio. This is early 90s. And so I got to know the radio announcer pretty well, a gentleman by the name of Roy Acuff, who is just, he's the guy that got me started and one of my favorite people in the world. And so I'm in college now, and I got an internship. It was a paid internship, hourly wage, to work at a public access operation. It was a cable company, actually called Paragon Cable at the time. Ended up being Time Warner. So I did all these shows. Like, I did the Mayor's Forum, and I ended up doing camera and audio and really got into it. I loved the artistic side of it. And, you know, we would edit. I did everything. I did graphics, worked the soundboard. I did handheld camera. It's as ambush television as you can get. Exactly what you'd imagine public TV would be. So through that, Paragon Cable had the rights to the Spurs preseason package, okay? And they needed a cameraman. So I said, well, I've been doing handheld for these talent shows. And matter of fact, I did Selena. You remember Selena?
Yeah,
who was
of course.
Murdered?
Yeah.
I did her final performance at the Alamo Dome. So I was a cameraman, and we were doing all these Tejano music festivals. I said, I could do the Spurs. I could do the NBA. And so I strapped this Ikigami 79 camera, which is about 10 feet long, and put that on my shoulder. And all the older camera guys, many of them are still there, going, I'll let the young kid have this big camera. We call it the Widowmaker, you know? And I did that. And the producer of that preseason game, producer and director back then was Mike Cicarillo. And we just struck up a friendship. He was a baseball player. He loved playing in the over 30 leagues, and I was a college baseball player. So that story started then. And then he brought me on as his very first intern and just exposed me to the world of television and got me a job, helped me get a job as the Jumbotron cameraman for the Spurs. So I worked for the team, and I did all the timeouts and the fan cam. And so that was my job while I was in college, and I was still playing baseball.
Wow.
And so that took me up till the year I graduated, which was 1993. And then the Missions were now moving into a new stadium. They were going to upgrade their broadcast. They wanted this guy, Roy, to have a partner. His previous partner had left to go teach English in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not. That was another stroke of luck for me. So I ended up getting this job with the minor league team, the Missions. And you mentioned the $25 a game. I'm making no money. I stayed in that job from 1994 to 2002 and nine hard years in the minor leagues. All during that time, I'm making a lot more money and able to support my family because I'm married now at this point. Got married right out of college, doing all these tech jobs. And so it made total sense for me to go run handheld camera and work all these sporting events. I did a lot of boxing, and I was there for the Pernell Whitaker, Cesar Chavez fight in the Alamo Dome. And remember the Sports Illustrated?
Yeah.
The cover was robbed. So I was there, and I worked on that show and ringside at the Alamo Dome. And so I did all these handheld jobs, and it made perfect sense to me that I would do all this work and make good enough living as a freelance production person and keep the dream alive to be a broadcaster and do the minor league baseball. It just fit perfectly, kind of like what Turner and the Brewers fit right now. And I never thought twice about, this is a crazy road to take. No one ever mentioned it. Mike Cicarillo was always great. You do whatever you need to do. I'll help you out. You got to sustain your career. And then there was a moment in 99 when I had pushed hard to get on the air with the Spurs. I was asking, can I do anything? And then Kick put me on this show, and Beatle ended up doing that show too. It was called Teammates when I did it. They changed the name to Coyote Clubhouse. It was about the mascot. And so, you know, Beatle came a few years after me, and she ended up taking over the show. And Cicarillo allowed me to do this show, but only interview players and personnel. So I was totally in a basketball sense, not in, you know, the social part of the Spurs. So that was a great break, and I was awful and nervous and had a face full of acne, and I was terrible. But the point was, in 99, I'd done just enough with the Spurs for them to know, and Kick was always in my corner. Like, I think this guy could do it. I think he could do it. Sideline guy gets a job in Dallas at the mothership. Fox Sports Southwest is what it turned into be. He leaves, and so the day after my daughter was born, I was booked to do a preseason game. This is 1999, October of 99. And you know, here comes my daughter. Now she's here, and I'm still like, this is the biggest break I've ever had. I've got to go do this game, right? So I did the game. Greg Papa was the play-by-play announcer, and I did that game, and it went okay. You know, so I wasn't great, but I did okay enough to get another chance. I ended up doing about 10 games that year. And so, but that season, 99, I was still, the games I didn't do sideline, I was still up in the Jumbotron control room doing graphics.
Amazing.
So I would literally go, I would show up early because I got paid extra early to go set up the cameras, two cameras, plug them in, white balance them, phase them, crawl on my belly underneath the stands at the Alamo Dome to power them up and, you know, get ready for the game, basically engineer that part of it. Matter of fact, the guy who hired me, Clinton Rathmill, we built Jumbotron. We moved it from Hemisphere Arena to the Alamo Dome, and I was just his lackey, and I, you know, I screwed in like video components. So all this is happening, and I'm getting great insights on the business and understanding how all this is working. And, you know, I got a brief stint with Monday Night Football as a runner, which was fantastic, and I'm doing all this really interesting stuff. But I'm still thought of as a tech guy. And that was okay. And I really love the art of being a cameraman. And I thought, like, I could probably do this for a living. It's really fun. And there's great skill in this.
Right.
We don't think about the human beings behind those cameras and the pressure
incredible skill
of shooting all of these great moments. But I gravitated toward those guys and gals anyway. So finally, 99 happened. I did these games when I part-time cameraman, audio guy, graphics dude, on the air sometimes. People were like, is this the same guy? Because I just saw him underneath the goal at the Alamo Dome, and now he's in a suit. And is this the same guy I just talked to? And I'd be like, hey, Jimmy, how's it going? He goes, wait, what? And then I'd be on television. So that year was the breakthrough year. And I'd actually gotten a couple of opportunities to do for ESPN to do like the AA All-Star game and the AAA All-Star game and Little League World Series regional games. So I'd done a little bit, but that year was like, okay, you want to be tech or talent.
Right.
And for me, it was like, I want to do both because if I'm just talent, I'm going to starve and I need this tech job. And so Kikarillo really went to bat for me. And the next season, which would be the 99-2000 season, the year after the Spurs won their first title, I became the full-time sideline reporter. And that's when I actually gave up all the tech jobs, the paid tech jobs. And so from that point on, I just went through and did the Spurs sideline. I ended up, you know, finishing my career with the Missions, got this great opportunity with Golf Channel. I did 4 years with the Golf Channel. That was like the first job that my wife actually could quit and be a stay-home mom. And we had a little girl. And so that was the one, like, okay, I finally can breathe a little bit and, you know, not have so much debt. And then it's just kind of clicked up from there on. Golf Channel, I worked with the Spurs and Golf Channel, and then I ended up leaving both of those to go to the Brewers in 2007. That was a huge moment, great opportunity for me. 2008, I mentioned the CC Sabathia moment. Turner came calling. They put me on the playoffs in 08. And then from Major League Baseball and TBS to the NCAA tournament to the NBA on TNT. And so that's kind of where it's all gone from that point. But it is a really unusual ride. But I would recommend that anybody who wants to do this for a living, learn the business from the inside. Learn how skillful the camera operators, the video techs, the audio people, the graphics, know their jobs, go to the trucks, understand the pressure that they deal with and the talent that is required and the speed is required to make these decisions. Am I going to shoot this guy with my camera and frame him, or am I going to shoot this guy? And that could make the difference in what the real story is or not. So I'm always connected to all the techs, and I still am. And I used to win money off these guys all the time when I'd go work for the Golf Channel, and they'd say, "You can't follow a golf ball." And so I'd get on one of those, you know, a big camera up on the tower, and I'd say, you know, I'd place a bet. All right, if I can follow this ball to the green, and they didn't know I was a cameraman. If I can follow this ball to green, you owe me dinner. And I would win money from these guys all the time because I would be able to follow it in the practice round.
I love that. You're like a tech shark, but you're right. I mean, these men and women are truly artists.
They are. And I appreciate the way you talk about them and write about them.
Yeah,
you're one of the few, maybe the only one that I know that does that. And I'm telling you, these folks, that gives them so much life.
Well, it's not even that. I'm honestly just fascinated by what I think. To put it in my world, I'm always interested in how skillful our IT people are, how the producers who can lay out a page, I consider that a true art because I can't do it. And so that's why I'm actually really interested in camera people and sound people and audio and television is because it's like Latin to me and it's fascinating to me how they conduct that orchestra in the same manner as it's very easy for me to understand like Bob Costas' skill as a host.
Right.
That's not that hard for me to understand, but that is hard for me to understand, which is why I'm particularly impressed by it. If it was my druthers, I wish more sports media people would write about them more. The reason, of course, you don't write about them, of course, is because it's hard to get the general
clicks.
Public.
Yeah.
Right. Writing about Chris Berman is easy because people have seen Chris Berman.
Have you ever watched a game from the inside of a
many
production
times.
Truck?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you'll never watch a game the same again, right?
No.
It's one of the more, I think
find
you
it
should televise.
For the producer and the director, it's an amazing amount of things they have to focus on in the game.
Yeah. And my biggest complaint or my mission is to get more young people, I sound like an old man, but more young people who want to do this business to pursue directing. We are in a major shortage of directors. We have plenty of selectors, people who cut cameras, but directing the right way.
Especially
we just lost Bill Webb.
Yeah, one of the greats.
An icon.
Maybe the great.
And
Harry
changed.
Who's the old the guy who did NBC, Harry, it'll come to me in a second. But Bill Webb and this guy, I think, are considered the two greatest baseball directors of Harry Coyle is the guy who did
Harry
Fisk's
Coyle,
game,
sure.
Famous. And Bill Webb is sort of the modern-day Rembrandt of this stuff.
Right. Yeah. And so how many 40 and under directors are out there. How many female directors are out there? I was just talking to Suzanne Smith, and she's fantastic.
Great. Yep. CBS.
And we are always having this conversation about female directors. Okay, who could be the next person? Because I think, you know, a woman's perspective on sports would bring a lot to what we do on television. This, the emotion, the personality, that's the best part of what we do, is when we get that shot of, remember Piccolo Girl? Remember Piccolo Girl, Villanova, and she ended up being on, she was on Letterman, but that's...
Well, you just eliminate, the problem too often with the business being so male-centric, et cetera, is, and oftentimes, quite frankly, too white, is you're eliminating the possibility of greatness coming into your profession. Somebody has a different eye, somebody sees something, so I'm with you on that.
That whole image, though, is just about... And I use this reference all the time. That director of that game was Renardo Lowe. The cameraman who shot that was this guy named Steve Angel. And that is an iconic moment from an NCAA tournament event. And the coordination of all of that, my words, Relo's directing, Steve Angel's eye. He could have, how many people are in a band?
Right. You got to get a little lucky, but a lot of times luck is the residue of preparation.
He's got lens on that camera and he's searching. Okay. He probably passed six or seven people. To a player, no.
I would say more.
To, you know, sax player, no. Drummer, no. Oh, Piccolo Girl.
Right.
She's crying. This is great. And so to me, that's what real TV is all about. And that's the fun part for me. And I know most people want to be on the air, and that's certainly, and I always did too, but man, I would love to be able to promote, and I try to as much as I can, but promote the talent. We always say the talent's in the truck, and there's so much talent in the TV industry and the way we tell stories, and we never think about the individuals behind those cameras.
Last one for me, Ryan, and that is, what's your favorite sideline story of interacting with Greg Popovich? I hope he yelled at you a couple times.
Oh, all the time. He yelled at me all the time. I think my favorite one was probably my second year. The Spurs were in the playoffs, and I have a great relationship with Pop, and he used to let me come into practice, which I thought was like a major coup back then, to be able to go watch the Spurs practice and watch him work. But, you know, his theme always was, every time at that point, he was still doing halftime interviews with the local station. He doesn't do it anymore, but I would wait for him, and I would walk him out. And every time he'd see me, every single game he'd see me, he's like, God, do we have to do this again? What? And I'd say, okay, what about the first half? What do you need to improve? And you know, this is not on camera. This is only paraphrased now. And I would have to do a report every game. And it was a beatdown. And I was interviewing Pop three times a day, shoot around before the, you know, at halftime, and then after the game for the post game. And oh my gosh, you talk about making somebody better quick. I got better fast because I had to think through every inch, every word, every pause. And at one point, this is probably like started in year two, and then maybe by year four, we're in the middle of the season, and he walks out, and he's, every time he's just like, God, why do we have to do that? He goes, I tell you what. Do we have to do this? Why is this important? This is a halftime. And I said, well, people want to hear from you. They want to hear what you have to say. And he goes, God, you know, he's just swearing at me and just going nuts. And he goes, I'll tell you what, this is what we're going to do. Mike Budenholzer, Bud, who was one of his assistants, now a head coach of the Atlanta Hawks. He goes, Bud knows everything I say. You ask him and you tell everybody that I said it. I went, win-win. This is great. I don't have to talk to Pop. I can quote Pop. So sure enough, Bud doesn't know this is happening, by the way. So here I am. He's always the last one out. So I'm, you know, here comes Bud. Hey, Bud, Pop told me to talk to you. And what did he say at halftime? He goes, what? So we had this whole deal where we talked about it. And then so now Bud, for the rest of my career in San Antonio, which would be three, four more years, I did 8 years there on the air. And I would just talk to Bud, and Bud would say, well, Pop said this, Pop said that, and Pop said this. Great. I'd go on the air, you know, hey, folks, well, Greg Popovich at halftime told his team, and it was great. It was good. There was one time, though, when they were in the playoffs, and we were all in the group media, and all the writers are there, and all the reporters, the local guys, and I asked Pop, they had just lost a tough game, and I had said, how was practice today? How was morale, in your opinion? And man, he looked at me like, and this is genius Pop. This is how he can wipe out an entire group with one phrase. He goes, "Ah, damn it. I don't expect that kind of question from you. I expect it from all these jokers." So he blew me up and he blew everybody else up that was in front of him. And everybody looked at me like, "Thanks a lot, Brian." Now he's pissed off and he doesn't want to talk anymore. So those are,
So you went through the ringer.
But I tell you what, the last thing I'll say about Pop is when I got the job in Milwaukee and I left the Spurs, he called me in his office. PR guy comes out, Tom James, says, "Pop wants to see you in his office." I thought he was mad at me for leaving in the middle of a season.
Right.
I honestly thought he was going to rip me a new one. But I walk in there and what he said that day, and I promised I wouldn't share it, but what he said that day lifted me up to a place and encouraged me to a place where I probably wouldn't have been able to go to Milwaukee and perform like I did, because you know he said things to me that day I had no idea he was even paying attention to, and he is so aware of every inch of that organization. And you know, he gave me a big hug. He goes, the one thing at the end he said, "You're a great asset to our organization, and you'll be a great asset to the Brewers. So we wish you nothing but the best, and you always have a friend in me." And I was like, man, I thought this guy hated me for years, but it was just...
There's a great dichotomy with Popovich, because on the one hand, I think, I'll be blunt, I think he bullies reporters, and it's quite frankly, at the same time, I think deep down, he's a genuinely great guy, and he cares about stuff, and he's principled. It kind of makes him an interesting human being.
Yep.
But you're not the only person who has those kind of stories, and they sometimes float out privately of him just reaching out to somebody that you wouldn't expect. And you know, at least in terms of, and this is just, I'll bring my own personal opinion in here, I think he is going to eventually be the person responsible for a major breakthrough, and that is Becky Hammond. I think is going to coach in the NBA
for sure.
One day,
no doubt.
And that's because of Greg Popovich. I don't know if it'll be the Spurs. Yeah, I don't know if it'll be another team, but he's the reason it will have happened. And then if it happens, and she's, forget about even sort of like spectacularly successful, if she just is an NBA coach and sort of performs at that level, then she will have broken a major ceiling for others after her. And it all starts with Popovich.
No question. And Popovich passing down this notion that anybody in this camp is worthy.
Correct.
And every player, and I've been around the Spurs, every player in that group, every Spurs player, all their personnel, Becky Hammond, it's not even that she's female. It's just she's a coach.
Correct.
And she deserves respect. She will be a very good head coach, I believe, soon. It's going to happen.
It doesn't matter. I mean, any Yahoo that thinks otherwise, the Spurs won the Summer League title under Becky Hammond. And if you want to...
That's right.
If you want to think that those guys weren't playing for real and it was a stunt, talk to any guy who's trying to make the NBA in Summer League. You just don't know what you're talking about.
It's a players' league, first of all.
Correct.
Coaches have an important role, but it is a players' league. There is a system in place. And
right. And players respect game. You agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. If you know the game, it doesn't really matter your gender.
And if she's won Pop over, she doesn't have to win anybody else.
Correct.
Over. So she obviously brings a lot to the table, and that's a great point. I still love the Spurs. I was in that organization forever. It's everywhere I go now, people will recognize the fact on my bio that I work for the Spurs, and you get that, you work for the Spurs.
Sort of a championship pedigree,
And it wasn't that way forever. I mean, I was there when Pop was, I was a cameraman when he was an assistant coach. It just wasn't that way, and it was always the beatdown. This was the, they were always the redheaded stepchild.
Not anymore.
With no offense to all the redheaded stepchildren out there.
All right, let's go through your resume, because that's going to take another hour. Brian Anderson is a Turner Sports broadcaster. You will see him on the NCAA tournament, including, as he mentioned, he has the opening game of the NCAA tournament in the, what are they calling this now, the first four?
First four has its own brand. I'll be there with Clark Kellogg Tuesday.
Okay, True TV, I think, has that game.
True TV,
You'll see him, of course, on Major League Baseball, as well as Turner's coverage of the playoffs. He does select NBA games, you still doing the PGA Championship?
Yep.
Okay, so let's make that current.
Yep.
You do the PGA Championship, and of course, his gig that many fans in the Midwest will know him for, and that is his 11th season as a play-by-play announcer for their Milwaukee Brewers for Fox Sports Wisconsin. Brian, I'm glad we got this done. You know, we've interacted now for a couple of years. You know, I have great respect for your work.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for coming into our studio to do this. I don't get to talk to people in person all the time. So thank you very much for being part of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Great to be with you, Richard.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up. My thanks to Brian Anderson. Totally enjoyed that. He's a really terrific broadcaster. And I had no idea of his backstory in terms of working in tech in San Antonio. That was really, really interesting. And told a story about grinding. You sort of see how his sort of POV on the business and how he got into it. And that's a true story of a guy who persevered. That clearly was not easy for him, but he really wanted to do this. So, and like I said, terrific broadcaster for Turner, and people in Milwaukee know how excellent he is. So I was glad he came in studio guests. It's like number 4 or 5, I think, on the out of the 107 episodes or so that we've done. So maybe we will have more. All right. Jim Trotter was the guest before Brian Anderson. And if you didn't hear that one, he talked about what goes on inside the Hall of Fame room for the voting. That was really fascinating, and how uncomfortable it was when Terrell Owens' name came up, and what the discussion was as well for Paul Tagliabue, or at least from his perspective. You're not allowed to reveal what others said, but he certainly described what he was feeling in the room, and that was really, really interesting. Future podcasts will include Seth Greenberg is coming up, the ESPN analyst, Laura Gentile, who runs ESPNW. We're going to do a round table, I think, either with Jim Miller and Neil Best, or just with Jim Miller and myself. And then we got some others coming down the pike that I will save for another time. For my producer, Lou Pellegrino, for the guys at Digital Media, for Chris Stone, John Worth, I'm Ryan Hunt, and Ben Eagle at Sports Illustrated. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.